Hey guys, so we're going to start the highlight of the evening, our panel. So we have a new panelist to announce. We have Todd White. Joining him are Ian Mendez of TSN 1200, James Gordon of the Ottawa Citizen,
hi,
and Amelia, editor of Silver 7 Cents. Moderating the panel will be Graham Nichols, of editor of the Sixth Sense. So let's get started.
I just wanted to start.
I get a booster seat, Kevin?
I just wanted to start off by thanking Kevin and the guys from Box Mullet for organizing this. This is pretty awesome for a turnout in August. And I'd also like to thank the panel for showing up to this event. I know Ian was excited to be here without Sean Simpson talking over him. First question, Amelia. A lot has transpired since the Senators knocked off the Montreal Canadiens in the first round of the playoffs. How do you characterize the past 50 months or so?
Bad. It hasn't been good. I think there's a tendency to think that this is a unique experience for our fandom and that no other teams are going through this, but I personally don't think most teams try and win the Stanley Cup. I think most teams try and make the playoffs, and I think that our experience of this is fairly common. We have the added thorn of the Alfredson saga, but for the most part, I don't think there's anything particularly unique. It's just sports sucks sometimes, and it's sucked for the past 15 months.
Has it sucked that bad for Sens fans, Ian?
Honestly, it's been great for talk radio. Not going to lie to you, it's a gold mine when the team has a roller coaster like that.
I know money's been kind of like a prevalent theme over the past year or so. I know you're a big fan of statistics. So is cost per point the only thing that matters?
Oh, boy. You know what? You look at the cost per point. I understand and every time we have Eugene on the radio, he'll bring up cost per point. I know that it drives some people over the wall. And you look at this team. Here's the one thing I'll say. If you look at this team's roster right now, their lineup, they don't have too many white elephants on the payroll, right? Like, if you look at it, probably the only contract people might roll their eyes at maybe is Colin Greening, right? At 3 years at 2.6. But that's 2.6. You don't have a guy on this payroll that's making $6 million that you're like, oh God, we got 4 more years of this guy or 5 more years of this guy. And you look at this and you say, Kyle Turris, that might be one of the best contracts in the league for a second line center. Erik Karlsson, every week goes by, that contract looks better and better. They've spent wisely. You can compete with a payroll in that range, but I completely agree with the fan base when you look at it and you say, okay, could they use another $5 or $6 million player? Absolutely. No one's going to deny that. But I can see Melnick's point where you don't want to spend foolishly on July 1st because you get the Clarksons or you fall into those traps. But
we tried to get David Clarkson. As Todd's saying that.
Here, I'll pass it over to Todd White.
Well, I agree with the, you know, they almost got Clarkson a couple years ago, but I agree with the idea. July 1st, you look at Niskanen and you look at Orpik, all those guys were guys that are getting overpaid. I like the model where you draft, you develop, and then you sign those guys to long-term contracts. You know them. There's so many guys that it happened in my career. You go to a new place. It's different. Sometimes it's hard to fit in with a new team. You fit in with a coach at a certain place, play in a certain system with certain players. Then all of a sudden you're brought into a new organization and it's just not the same. It's hard to duplicate what you've been doing. So July 1st, I think there's a lot of mistakes can be made. And I, like you said, Ian, I think that Sens going forward have room that they can sign some homegrown talent that they're developing and be able to keep a real good nucleus together and grow together. I think that there's a lot of teams that, you know, were panicked a little bit this year when the cap was, you know, $500,000 or $1 million less than they thought. It created some real big problems for people just because they're right at the cap, and the Sens have room to be able to sign their own players once they do become, you know, worthy of next contracts.
Do you have confidence in ownership to make that financial commitment moving forward because they are one of the lowest spending teams on payroll?
Well, I think so. I think that, you know, I think the one thing is that you have to have the players that, you know, come July 1st, it's just crazy. Like the money and term, like that's the biggest thing. It's the term. Like I think you look at a team like Nashville. Nashville went this year with some guys on 1 year contracts, and if they work out, great. If they don't, it's not that long term hit that you're stuck with. You know, I think that once these, you know, young guys like Stone and those types of guys that are coming up now, once they become, you know, and I think they're going to have to open up their wallets this year to keep, you know, the Bobby Ryans and Anderson and, you know, MacArthur and Mathot, those four guys, they're going to have to make decisions on those guys. I'll be curious to see what they do, which guys they're going to get signed first. And I'm sure all four of those guys are kind of looking at each other and wondering, you know, who's going to be the first guy to, you know, the domino to fall.
James, your newspaper's been most forthright in their interest in Eugene Melnyk's financial situation, and it seems to be a huge talking point for fans. Is it overblown? Do you feel it's overblown, or should fans legitimately be concerned about this franchise?
I think it depends on who you ask if it's overblown. I mean, if you might not know, I was the sports editor the last couple of years until a few months ago. And, I mean, our take on it was that we sort of share accountability with some of the same people as the senators, and that, the senators have to, are ultimately accountable to their fans, and we're ultimately accountable to our readers, and a lot of those readers are Sens fans. So, the way we looked at it was, it's relevant. The team obviously can't spend with some of the better teams in the league. And, I think, you know, when with people looking more at numbers and such right now, it is relevant because, you know, if you look at the numbers of the teams that are legitimate Stanley Cup contenders, then those are teams that are usually within, a very small, gap, from the cap ceiling. I mean, if you look at this last year, I think the Rangers are maybe the furthest from the cap ceiling at maybe $2.5 million. So, you know, you can be a bubble team and not spend to the cap. But, you know, from what we've seen so far, and some team might come along and surprise us and be that team that breaks the mold and spends around what the Senators are spending and win a Stanley Cup. But, you know, based on what's going on, spending does matter in this league. And, you know, to Todd's point before, I think a lot of where the Senators are financially, you'll see come out with the Mathot and the Ryan and that situation, because these are guys that they brought in to be their core. And if they're not willing to pay them or are not able to pay them what I think they expect, which is fair market value, then I think that's a legitimate concern for fans and something that is relevant.
Perfect segue for Amelia. Although the Senators are reportedly in talks with each of their 2015 impending UFAs, how confident are you that the Senators can come to an agreement with guys like Mathot, Anderson, Ryan, and MacArthur?
I'm pretty confident they'll come to an agreement with Mark Mathot. I don't think he wants to move. Moving's a hassle. Someone like Bobby Ryan, I don't know why he wouldn't try free agency. I would, but I think they'll come to terms with some of them. I don't think they'll come to terms with all of them. I think the most likely one they won't come to terms with is Bobby Ryan, for all the obvious and not obvious reasons. Should they pay him as much as it would take to sign a guy who, at this point, is slated to be a marquee free agent next summer? I don't know. I think there's good evidence to suggest that that might not be in the best interest of the team long term. That said, there's other reasons for signing players, and some of them is perception. If he was a marquee piece last summer to make people feel less feels about Daniel Alfredson, then they're going to feel more feels when he leaves. I don't think it makes sense to re-sign Craig Anderson, and not just because I don't like him. I just think moving forward, that doesn't make sense. But I don't think it's a guarantee that you should re-sign all of these guys just because it would make us feel better about the team's financial situation. I don't think re-signing some of these guys would make me feel better about it. And I think they're all likely to stay except for Bobby Ryan.
Is everyone else tepidly optimistic that they can come to terms with these free agents, or is it
tepidly optimistic. No, I think the one thing we got to remember is if they go into training camp and they don't have a deal signed, I don't think it's a cause for concern. Remember last year, San Jose went into the year, Thornton and Marlowe. I think that got done during the year. I think Kessel and Phaneuf.
They're trying to trade Joe Thornton?
Yeah. But this idea that you have to have a guy signed before training camp, I think is a little bit misleading. You can get a deal done during the season, and yeah, it can be a bit of a distraction, but there's nothing to say that you can go into October, November, December, and then get the guy signed. And maybe as an organization, that's not a bad play either. Maybe you want to see Bobby Ryan for 3 months because you only really saw him for 3 months last year. And you want to make sure that if you're going to invest 7 or 8 years in somebody at 7 and 8 per, that you've seen, have enough of sample size on this guy. So I still think if I was to look at it, if I had to prioritize the likelihood of guys signing, I'd say Bobby Ryan would be number one that they would be able to re-sign. I think Clark MacArthur would be two. I think Mark Mathot would be three. And I think the likelihood of Craig Anderson coming back would be four. If I had to rank the four guys.
I thought you were going to come full circle on that and come back to Colin Greening's contract, right? Because he would have been an unrestricted free agent.
Yeah.
And they signed him to a deal, and now it doesn't look as favorable as it did back then. But I think you're right. And yeah, it's a good point. Moving on. Todd, recently Randy Lee referred to David Legwand as a buffer for Mika Zibanejad. How do you envision Paul McLean using David Legwand this season?
Well, I think, you know, obviously when you get brought in, whenever, you know, you're getting brought in, Jason Spezza is leaving, you're getting brought in. Obviously there's a huge hole to fill there. I think he's going to be a guy that is going to be playing in a lot of situations. You know, I think obviously he's played in Nashville for many, many years and, you know, went to Detroit. It's tough. It's tough when you leave and go somewhere new, partway through the season. So he's a guy that can play a good two-way game. You know, the centers, if there's one problem I had with him last year was probably the defensive play of their centerman, not wanting to be a centerman in the defensive zone. So, you know, I think that, you know, Legwand, you know, I think it's a buffer. I think that I can see Zibanejad, if he plays the way he can, I can see him pushing Legwand, you know, all season for ice time, which is, you know, a good thing for the Senators.
Who do you envision getting more of the more offensively skilled line mates?
Well, I think that those types of decisions come with, you know, if you look at it, like Zibanejad didn't even make the team last year, in training camp. I think the decisions are made. It's, you know, who you play with changes based on, you know, you can start off a season. Remember when I was with Atlanta, I started off the season. It was with Kovalchuk, myself, and some rookie, and it lasted like three games, and then that guy got switched off, you know, so. Line mates, if it's not clicking, they're going to change it around. We'll look at, you know, Bobby Ryan was brought in to play with Jason Spezza. They obviously, you know, everybody thought last year Spezza was going to have the most offensively skilled line mates, you know, that he could have last year. And obviously that didn't really come to fruition because the two most offensive guys were being put with Turris. So it's what chemistry, what coach sees in chemistry. And, you know, I think that I'd like to see Zibanejad get more of an opportunity offensively just because I think he has the potential to really do some things.
James, I'm looking at the Senators' depth chart as we're talking about line combinations and roster juggling and the Senators' depth chart. Jean-Gabriel Pageau and Curtis Lazar are two young names that have been discussed a lot recently. Is there room for either player on this team's roster, and do the Senators have to make another move to accommodate them?
I would say so at this point. I mean, you know, it's a team that is losing a lot of offense this year with Jason Spezza and Alishamsky going to Dallas. And they may find themselves in a position where they think a guy like Pageau can come in and do that. And, I mean, it's hard to kind of figure out what they're going to do just because of the contract situation with a lot of these guys. And I know one of your questions was on defense too. And I think, it's going to be an interesting training camp again this year. Sometimes you go into training camp and everything is set and, you know, it's going to be like a really long month waiting for the season to start. But, you know, I wouldn't even fathom trying to sort of suss out what their depth chart is going to be. I think there's a lot of unanswered questions about the team and who's going to play well with who. And, yeah, I mean,
maybe that mystery trade will come to fruition.
Maybe.
Ian, Alex Chiasson is one piece in the Senators roster from the Jason Spezza deal that will actually play on the team next year. How much pressure is on him to actually perform at a high level next season? And what do you expect or anticipate from him?
I honestly don't think there's much pressure on Alex Chiasson coming in. I don't think people are going to look at Alex Chiasson and say, that's what we got for Jason Spezza. I think people are intelligent enough in this market to know that Jason Spezza goes out and nobody of his value comes back in. Not one of those three guys coming back is going to be Jason Spezza. So I think you look at Alex Chiasson, you go into it with the assumption that he'll be top nine guy, third line. If I was to look at it, I know they're kind of stacked on the right side too, but if I was to start the year, I'd say this guy's probably going to be a third line player. I'm not sure that he's got enough skill to warrant time on the top six. And I think a lot of people in this market would like to see Mike Hoffman, Mike Stone, Mika Zibanejad maybe as a line, and maybe that's your second line, and Dave Legwand's on your third line, whatever. But like James said, it's a fool's game to try and figure out the line combinations right now. But I don't think that people are going to look at Alex Chiasson and say that he's going to score 20 goals or he's going to carry any of the offensive load on this team. I just don't see it.
Okay. Todd, to follow up on your point from earlier, you were referring to the centers being more committed with their centermen in the defensive zone. Obviously, through the moves that the Senators have made this offseason, there is that commitment to harder-working players. Do the Senators have enough talent to compete for a playoff spot next year?
I think so. I think the big thing is how the young players develop. I think like the Mark Stone, Lazars, guys like that, the biggest thing will be able to manufacture goals. Obviously, the tourist line did really well last night with last year with scoring. It's going to be more of a committee approach, and obviously Carlson's another year removed from having the injury, and obviously he had a great year last year, but not the same as the Norris Trophy winning season. So I don't think scoring is going to be the problem. I think it's going to be they need to make that renewed commitment to team defense, and that'll be what will carry them to a playoff spot, I think.
And Amelia, despite his offensive contributions during the 2013-14 season, Erik Karlsson had some problems on and off the ice. Do you think he can return to his Norris Trophy form?
Yes. I have not had an Achilles injury. I have injured myself lying on the couch, and that's hard to come back from. So I'm not trying to do anything elite with my couch lying. But this guy... But this guy just needed, it's insane. I don't have a medical degree, but from what I've read and from what I understand, coming back in 10 weeks is not possible. And he did. I think the biggest knock against his game was that our team missed the playoffs. I don't think that was so much about his game as the team as a whole. I think he's going to get several hat tricks, I guess, is how I'm going to finish that.
James, a lot of attention is going into what the Senators spend on and off the ice. A number of blogs and online forums have talked about what they spend on in their hockey ops department. With the recent hires of people like Kyle Dubas or Tyler Dello, do you anticipate the Senators getting into that market anytime soon? And as a team that's kind of financially limited in what they can spend on the ice, is that an avenue where they should pursue?
Well, you would think so, and I don't know if it was you or... I think it was Chirp maybe who tweeted the list of all the scouts and front office staff the Buffalo Sabres are building right now, but it's absolutely insane. And I think that's a way that you have to go at this point in the game. I mean, it's not really a hidden thing, and obviously there's been a lot of press with Dello and all that, and from what I understand there's quite a few teams kind of already looking into this before all this kind of came out. I think some of that was buried by kind of the center of the hockey universe with their sort of war against the analytics people and trying to use kind of these old school hockey narratives to argue why they were doing the right thing. And I think it was interesting this year that it happened in Toronto, that there was this big collapse and, sort of, everybody was talking about how this was due to happen, and it almost didn't because it was so late in the season, and then it did. And I think, you look at Toronto, they obviously are feeling that because they wouldn't go and hire a guy like Dubas, and they wouldn't have Brendan Shanahan talking about trying to learn Fenwick and Corsi on the airplane before his press conference. It's something that people are paying attention to now, and I think that it's getting a little more mainstream acceptance. And for a team like the Senators, which may or may not have much of a front office staff anymore with some of the guys who've left to join Tim Murray in Buffalo, I think it's a terrifically efficient way to sort of keep up. I mean, I was chatting with Tim Murray one time at the morning skate about advanced stats, and you know, he said that the Senators, you know, collected them and he looked at them, but you know, he didn't necessarily need them to be a good judge of talent or whatever. And he said it's good for people who can't watch all the games. So if you have a smaller staff and you can't watch all the games, it's nice to have some numbers that you can refer to if you don't necessarily know everything that you would like to know about a player.
That's Tim Murray. No fucks given. All right, Ian, recently it came out, Don Brennan tweeted, I believe it was, Friday night, that the Pierre Dorion had actually traveled down to Chicago to speak with Craig Anderson's representatives. Craig Anderson will turn 34 next year. Usually history has shown that goaltenders at that age, it's probably not a wise idea to give them a long-term deal. At some point, I'd imagine the Senators have to give the keys to the car to Lehner. How do you envision the Senators' goaltending situation playing out moving forward?
I think this year they'll come into camp, and I think it'll be an open competition, provided they don't move Craig Anderson before October the 1st, which I can't see happening. And then, you know, I look at the situation for Craig Anderson, and I say, if I'm Craig Anderson, why wouldn't I go to July 1st next year? Because this would be the only time in his career where he would get to July 1st and be an unrestricted free agent and really have the resume that he does and can say that he's the number one guy. Because remember, when Ottawa traded for him from Colorado back in 2011, he signed an extension just before he went to free agency. So he never went to free agency. And before that, I think he went from Florida to Colorado, but he was kind of like a middle of the pack guy. He's never been to free agency as a legit number one guy. And don't think for a second that even though he's 34, he could go to the open market next year. I think he can maybe get 5.5, 6, even on a 2-year deal. Who knows whether it's Edmonton or Calgary or some team that might need a legitimate guy to start games for them. So if I was Craig Anderson, just looking at it from his perspective, that's what I would do. Now, I don't know if Ottawa's got a game plan where they would say, look, we'd like you to come in and share the load with Robin Leonard for 2 years or 3 years. But if I'm Craig Anderson, I would say, no, I'm going to try to hit a financial home run, at least one of them, because I've never been to July 1st as a legit number one goalie.
Fair enough. Last question before I start turning it over to everyone else here who wants to ask a question. Todd, with defensemen like Mark Mathot, Jared Cowan, Patrick Wierkoch, Chris Phillips, and Mark Borowiecki on one-way contracts, how do you envision the Senators' defensive situation settling itself out on the left-hand side?
Well, you know, I think, obviously, when Chris Phillips resigned, my initial thought was, wow, we have a lot of left defensemen. But I don't know what they're going to do. I think that, you know, Wierkoch's name was always kind of the guy that they thought would be, if they were making a trade, that he'd be the guy that'd be kind of moved. You know, Borowiecki's out of options, so he's going to be here this year. I think it's going to be a really, you know, good training camp in terms of competition. You know, a couple guys that were expected to play big minutes last year didn't have great seasons. You know, Cowan and Wierkoch kind of struggled. They both, you know, if you think about guys who got contracts last summer, from, you know, Cowan to Wierkoch to even Colin Greening, you know, those are the three of the guys that really struggled last year that they weren't able to live up to the contract. So hopefully this year, all three of them are kind of a year removed from getting that contract and they'll be able to play better. You know, I think it's going to be a healthy competition, and obviously somebody might have to move over to the right side to be able to be in the lineup every night.
Okay. I'm going to start turning it over to you fans. I'll just walk around, Kevin, and then I'll be easy. So if you have a question for the panel, just raise your hand and I'll come over and try and make my way through everybody as quickly as possible. Peter Raymakers. How's it going? How are you?
So it seems to me that there's sort of two leadership groups on the team right now. There's sort of Phillips and Neal are sort of the old guard, and then there's this new guard that's led by Carlson and Turris and MacArthur and Mathot. And I'm sort of wondering what your take is on that, those sort of separate cohorts, especially in light of the fact that we're looking for a new captain right now. Which direction do you think this team is going to go in?
Yeah.
You can all answer.
I
don't know all that much about leadership or about being a good dude in a dressing room, but I do know that it doesn't work as well when you're not as good as the average player on the ice. And I think that, having said that, you should probably make this transition complete and turn to younger players. If there was any benefit, and there wasn't, to Alfredsson leaving, it's that you have an opportunity to turn over a whole new page, go in the direction of a new leadership group, and I think you should probably go with Turris or Carlson, but Carlson, because why not? People just pick their favorite players, right? That's how they do this, so that's my answer.
If you had to ask me, I would think Erik Karlsson is going to be named the captain of this team. And there's no wrong or I think sometimes in pro sports, especially those of us in the media and fans too are probably guilty of this, we put far too much emphasis on the role of captain. And maybe Todd can speak to this a little bit too. Obviously, you have to have a leadership group, but think about this. The New York Rangers made the Stanley Cup final last year. Who was their captain? The answer is nobody. Nobody was wearing the C. And, you know, if there's a vacuum in there, you know, last year it was Brad Richards who picked it up for the Rangers. It's all about the way you conduct yourself inside that room rather than the letter that you're wearing on your jersey. And so to me, I think Erik Karlsson, last year, as we've talked about, was a very difficult year for Erik, but I honestly think this guy's going to roll into camp this year. I think he's going to blow people away. I think he's going to take ownership of his game. I think he's going to take ownership of this team. And I think if you had to ask me who's going to be the captain opening night, my answer would be number 65.
I think if you ask me, I'd probably go, you know, if they can get Mark Methot locked up to a longer term deal that, I don't know that Erik Karlsson is there yet in terms of, a leadership position on the team, whatever that means. I mean, maybe you give Karlsson an A and then you let Methot kind of take the heat because Mark Methot is comfortable in a lot of the annoying roles of being a captain, which is talking to us and answering, you know, difficult questions after games and doing so in a way that Daniel Alfredsson would have done, which was, you know, with class and knowing that, that those questions are going to be there and being ready for that. And maybe that gives Erik Karlsson a little more time to grow into that role because obviously he's the face of the franchise, as a player and maybe that's enough for now. I don't know if Todd has any thoughts on that?
Well, I think if it's not Karlsson this year, if they decided to wait, let him continue just to play the game and not really worry about, you know, having the added pressure of the C. You know, I think a guy that has the respect of the room that's been there forever is a guy like Chris Phillips. And, he has the respect of all the guys. And when he says something, even when I played there, when he'd stand up and say something, the guys listen. So he'd be a guy that I'd be rooting for if one of the guys to get it for a couple of years to before, you know, Karlsson ends up getting it.
And if I can make one more point too, I think people talk all the time about the prototypical captain. And I always say this, you look at the Winnipeg Jets, right? Who's their captain? It's Andrew Ladd. And he plays that prototypical Canadian game and he's sort of everything you want in a leader. But what about the Winnipeg Jets? Where have they been the last couple of years with Andrew Ladd as their leader? Answer is, they're out of the playoffs and they're riddled with inconsistency. So again, I just think that sometimes we put far too much emphasis or importance on that role.
Don't blame Andrew Ladd for Ondřej Pavlik.
All right. We got a question over here from Luke.
Hi guys. This is for whoever wants it. My question is, what young player do you think most has to step up this season and why is it Jared Cowan?
Go ahead. Oh, I get to follow that up. All right. I think if you look at it, that's you're bang on. Jared Cowan's the guy that you go into last year who had the expectations on him signing the contract for 4 years at whatever, $12.5 million. Jared Cowan was terrible last year, but you know what? Jared Cowan will tell you that he was terrible. It's not like if you talk to Jared Cowan, he's not going to try to sugarcoat it. He knows he was bad. So, yeah, I would put him at the top of the list of guys that's sort of under the age of 23, 24 that need to improve their game, it's Jared Cowan would be number one.
I think Jared Cowan having a good season or not won't change that much for the Sens' overall fortunes. I think Mika Zibanejad stepping up and playing really well in the second-line center role actually makes more of a difference to the overall outcome. But, yeah, for everyone's health and sanity, Jared Cowan probably does need to be a lot better.
I concur. I think that a lot of his issues, and that's something that he said a few times, were psychological for him. I think he was worried about getting re-injured more than the injury was actually bothering him. I think that, you know, he played the full season, and, you know, I think he got there in terms of physical, but I think that, and hopefully for his sake, because he, to Ian's point, I mean, to his credit, he's always accountable about it, and he knew as well as anyone how poorly he played last year. So hopefully for his sake, he can sort of get over the hump and stop worrying about, you know, getting hurt again and just play the way that he did when the team saw him as a potential top two defenseman.
Hey guys, Penn from Sens Call-Ups. Just seeing, why do you guys think that Paul McLean really loves the Greening Smith Neal line and puts them out pretty much at any opportune time?
This is going to get back to the lack of analytics.
Well,
right?
I was just going to say, I think a lot of people wondered why there was such a reliance on that line because, you know, we're talking about the most penalized team in the league, and this was a line that took a lot of really bad penalties at bad times, and I don't know why that is. The Senators obviously are big on hard work and character guys and energy guys, and this is a line that if you were to put one together, then that's what you would describe it as. So I think that I guess Paul McLean trusted that line, and I'm not inside Paul McLean's head. We asked him that quite a few times, but
yeah, I think when you look at it in an ideal world, that's your fourth line. Like that line should be playing 8 to 10 minutes a night, and that's your fourth line. But yeah, you're right. Last year there were certainly instances where they played north of 13, 14 minutes, and you're asking yourself why. And I think probably lines up with James's theory, which is if Paul McLean was trying to create some structure and maybe try to make other guys more accountable and say, look, this is the way you want to play, or this is the style that you want to have, that's what we try to do. But further to James' point, when that same line is taking as many even strength penalties as they were, it kind of makes you wonder what the rationale was behind it.
It feels like it was more of a criticism of the top two lines for whatever reason than it was a reflection of how wonderful they were playing. Unfortunately, it was not a winning strategy because they did not make the playoffs, so hopefully we don't see any more of that.
Hey, guys. First off, thanks, everybody, for doing this. This is a really awesome thing. I'm going to ask you to take a very dangerous step and walk into the psyche of the Sens fan collective. Now, my first confession, I live in downtown Toronto, about 100 meters from the Air Canada Centre. My second confession is I've married a Leaf fan. She's not here right now. She's lovely. Toronto, you go down there, you ask them who their biggest rival is, Montreal. I've been to Sens games here where the loudest cheer on the night is when you see the Leafs score go up and they're down 4-1. What is it going to take, do you think, in terms of the Sens performance or something like that, achievements, for the hatred of Toronto to be second, I think, sometimes to the cheering for Ottawa? Because sometimes it drives me nuts.
Win.
We have, since they've beaten us in the playoffs, went to a cup final.
Stanley Cup? Did I need to clarify that?
Just to build on that, though, I mean, that is what it comes down to. When they were the pesky Sens and everybody fell in love with them, you went to an Ottawa-Montreal game and it was, you know, 85-90% Sens fans as opposed to 50, which is what it would normally be. People want a team that they can be proud of, I think, and I think that people in the city are willing to come out for that team, and it's sort of the paradox with the financial side of the team is, you know, people are willing to, you know, people made a lot of the finicky fan thing, but I think that if you look at the attendance and you look at everything, the fan base is here, but the fan base is not going to be the Toronto fan base that will show up regardless for 8 years with no playoffs. I think the fan base here requires something in return for that level of buy-in. I think the fan base maybe was a little spoiled in the 2000s when it was the best team in the league almost every year. And it's hard to kind of fall back from that and have a bubble team all the time. So, I think if the Senators can go back to being a team.
Thank you, Tom.
I think if you see this team become, you know, at least arguably a Stanley Cup contender again, then I think that you'll see that again, and you won't see, you know, which was probably embarrassing as a Sens fan, I assume, where you went to a Toronto game and it was, you know, getting up to the 60-70% Toronto fans because everybody had checked out her.
I just think that what it's going to take is, I still maintain the Senators have never beat the Leafs in a game that matters. And I think that's a big part of this whole psyche thing, is that the only times Ottawa's beaten, you think about what's your most memorable beatdown at Toronto, it probably happened in October, right? Like in 2005 when Heatley scored 4 goals or McGrattan knocks out Ty Domi. Like, all the important games happened in October. It's going to take beating Toronto when it matters if you want to get down to it. If they get an opportunity again in the playoffs, of course, that would be great. But to me, that's a big part of the psyche. At least with Montreal, you've got the one playoff series under your belt. You're like, okay, we beat them. But there's always this, it's like a Red Sox-Yankee thing where until you beat them, they're going to hold it over your head and you're going to have this inferiority complex that it's going to manifest itself in ways like you do with the out-of-town scoreboard.
If I may, just to get back to your question, how many season tickets are being sold in Ottawa? 14,000? Approximately 14,000 season tickets? Less than that, 13. Let's go with 13 out of 20,000. Every Toronto game that I've seen, that I've attended, there were more Toronto fans than Ottawa fans. So the number one rule, Ottawa fans, just don't sell your tickets. Because you have sold your tickets to the opposing team. Because we should have at least, you know, if we have 13,000 people, we should have 13,000 fans in the house. And we don't. So the number one problem, I think, it's us, the fans. Keep your tickets for those games. I know I'm from Quebec. I'm Francophone. I hate Montreal. Always hated them. Hey. But it's true. Sometimes the two games that I used to hate the most were against Montreal and Toronto. I felt bad attending those games because I knew that the opposing team would be shitting on my head. But we have to stand together and keep those tickets. And, you know, the Canadian Tire Center, it's our house. And we have to keep our house.
I just say sell your tickets for whatever you can get for them. That's just me.
I was informed by Kevin that this has to be the last question. So if I didn't get to you, I'm sorry. Better be a good one.
Okay, well, I'll try to make this a good last question here. All right, so part of what was coming out in the media at the end of last season was talk that Paul McLean was trying to be a lot harder on his team as a whole instead of trying to be more of a mentor and a guide to the team, but also to younger players in general. There was a lot of being a hard ass, just trying to, you know, be more of a taskmaster in hopes of trying to take the team to the next level. What are your thoughts on that as an approach? And obviously, you know, we can say initially that it wasn't successful, but do you think that, was this Paul McLean's own doing himself, or was this dictated by someone else? And ultimately, were it to happen again, could it perhaps maybe end in a different result given different situations?
I have no idea because I don't talk to players or coaches, but I don't think it's necessarily a bad idea to approach any new season if you're a coach, especially of a relatively young team, that you might need to have an evolution in your relationship with these players. I mean, we think of it as coach-player, but I was talking with Luke Christie about this yesterday, that some of the best coaches have actual relationships with their players, and it's an evolution. And as these players mature, different things are required of you as the leader of these players. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing that he thought he needed to approach 2013, 2014 differently than he had in the past. Obviously, there was a disconnect, and I think that's a bit troubling considering Paul McClain is supposed to be an excellent communicator. But I think the premise is fine, and I think he's a smart enough guy to realize what didn't work about that process and go into this season with that knowledge. I also think that he seems a big enough guy to accept that there were flaws on his end too. It wasn't just that player X was disappointing. It was that there were things he was doing that weren't working. So I think it could be fine going into next season. And as with any coach, if it's not, they get fired.
I think it would have stemmed from Paul McClain if he kind of read between the lines in the availabilities at the end of the season. I think if it was coming from Brian Murray, he wouldn't have thrown Paul McClain under the bus by calling him out on it. Even though there were some mixed messages there with ownership and saying, you know, more people need to do their jobs, but then, you know, the GM saying we need a more touchy-feely coach. I think it's, I've talked to several coaches about just what's changed about coaching, and I mean, it has to be collaborative now. I mean, look at the salaries of the players that the coach is bossing around. You might think that means nothing, but I don't think it means nothing. And I think that, you know, it's a lot easier, as the cliche goes, to fire the coach than to fire the players. So, I think you need a coach who does have, who can implement his plan in a way that the players will accept without being pushed around. There's different ways that they do that. I spoke with Kurt Kleinendorf when he was the coach down in Binghamton, and his way was, the way to get his message through the dressing room is to get the trust of a leadership group that they can carry that message into the room and get them to buy in through those guys. And you always have to change your approach, and I know that's one thing that the players in Nashville always said about Barry Trotz. They're always mixing it up and finding new ways to do things. But I think if a coach is too, and I think, if I'm not mistaken, Daryl Sutter talked about that too in leading the Kings to a couple cups, is he had to change the way he coached. So I think if you get a coach who's too antagonistic now, you risk losing your room a lot quicker. And you know, some of the stuff that happened this year, you know, with Mark Methot getting scratched and obviously being pretty pissed about it a couple times and that sort of thing, you saw some cracks there. So, you know, it would probably be useful for Paul McClain to go back to what was working, and if that, and that got him two nominations for the Jack Adams and one win. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So maybe try that again, and if that doesn't work again, then you're really at square one. But
yeah, I think the biggest issue here is the perception that this team has been a bunch of coach killers, right? In the last 6 or 7 years, where Paddock gets axed, Hartsburg gets axed, Clouston gets axed. Paul McClain comes in, wins the Jack Adams in his second year, nominated his first year, and you're thinking, okay, finally we have a degree of stability behind the bench, and then what happens? It all falls apart last year, and then you're saying, what are these whispers that Paul McClain gets fired? Like, if Paul McClain got fired last year, don't for a second think that we all wouldn't have said, okay, there's a serious problem with this organization. But I agree with James. I think Paul can go back to the guy that he was in 2013. He admitted that probably in about November, he was a little bit too hard on some of his star players and challenged them maybe in ways that he hadn't challenged them before. And it's not to say that he shouldn't be able to challenge your players, just maybe the approach that he took was a little bit more confrontational than he would have preferred. So I think you'll see back to the old sort of relaxed Paul McClain, a guy that, like I said, he didn't get stupid overnight. I just think if this team has better goaltending, you're not going to hear questions about the coach, and you're not going to hear questions about the captaincy, because goal, as we all know, I hate to boil it down to this, but goaltending makes all of those problems go away. And of course, we're going to end with a goaltending comment. Yeah. And I think our moderator, Graham Nichols, has left too, so. All right.
I'll pass the mic to Kevin.
All right, I want to thank our panelists.